service. The 27 Club is a production of iHeartRadio and Double Elvis Media. Jimi Hendrix died at the age of 27, and he lived a life full of more than its fair share of shocking moments. I can give you 27 reasons why that statement is true. 11 would be the number of seconds that Jimmy's sometimes girlfriend, Devin Wilson, would suck on Mick Jagger's bleeding finger at Jimmy's birthday party, just to get a rise out of the birthday boy. 8 more would be the number of minutes he lasted on stage in Denmark before completely blacking out, a result of being overworked and overdrugged, stretched thin by insomnia and sleeping pills. Another would be the number of German anarchist bands that played on a burning stage while Jimmy's entourage narrowly escaped hell on earth in a helicopter. And 7 would be the number of days he had left to live after he was visited by the ghost of Otis Redding in his room at the Cumberland Hotel in London, soon after he played his final public concert, all totaling 27. On this, our 10th episode of Season 1, Bleeding Fingers, Sleeping Pill-Fueled Blackouts, Burning Stages, Hotel Hauntings, and the Always Searching Jimi Hendrix. I'm Jake Brennan, and this is the 27 Club. Mick Jagger cried out in pain and shock and looked down at his finger. He had pricked the end of it on a blade that he was using to slice up a small pile of cocaine on the kitchen counter. The white anthill of coke sat there, one little lump, now dotted with flecks of blood, like food coloring on some flour. Mick was dressed in a zoot suit, gaudy rings on his skinny mitts. He held the tip of his cut finger with the opposite hand to try to stop the blood from flowing, from getting all over the black and white checkered suit. He looked ridiculous. Ridiculously awesome, that is. And now he felt ridiculous, too. "Bloody hell," he shouted, and then laughed at his unintentionally corny joke. The other Rolling Stones, loitering next to him in the kitchen, laughed along. Keith Richards mumbled something incoherently, handed his burning cigarette to a woman nearby, and went in for the coke pile anyway. Mick Jagger could piss off if he thought his little hand injury was going to delay the rest of them from achieving liftoff. Mick asked for a band-aid, something, and this injured finger was the finger he pointed at, the one he waved in the air every night on stage, when he'd hold his other hand to his waist, elbow stuck at a 45-degree angle, and wagged his finger around like an accusatory rooster. He should insure this finger. No finger in rock and roll was like this one. And whose apartment was this anyway? Who knew where the emergency kit was at? And what does Mick Jagger have to do to get a band-aid on his goddamn finger? From across the kitchen, Devin Wilson answered the call. She left her post at Jimi Hendrix's side and went straight to Mick's aid. Devin Wilson, tall, intoxicating, beautiful black super groupie. And she was a walking pharmacy, drug buddy, bed buddy, confidant in all manners of dope and sex to a who's who of rock stars in the late 60s. Since 1967, an unshakable presence around Jimmy. She was alternately Jimmy's friend, his lover, his dealer, his gopher, his critic, his weakness. Unapologetically jealous and possessive, Devin wouldn't think twice about slipping a Mickey to another girl talking to Jimmy. She'd play gatekeeper at the studio, deciding who was in and who was out, sit down next to the engineer to establish dominance, never minced words with Jimmy. When he played well, she'd tell him. When he sucked, she'd let him know. Devin was on Jimmy like white on rice. Jimmy would quit her, only to pick her back up again. Here comes Dolly Dagger, her love so heavy gonna make you stagger. She was undeniable, a force, gale winds. Whenever she blew into Jimmy's life, waters got rocky pretty damn fast. And it was Devin who had thrown this party at a friend's apartment in Manhattan, a celebration of Jimmy's 27th birthday on the 27th day of November, 1969, his golden birthday. And now, even on his golden birthday, at a gathering of friends in his honor, Devin was going to assert that dominance. Go ahead and show everyone, show Jimi Hendrix who was in control. Devin pushed through the mass of party people, through the Rolling Stones with their coke noses and cigarette smoke halos, and made her way right to Mick Jagger's side. She took Mick Jagger's injured hand in hers and slowly pulled it to her lips. She opened her mouth and guided Mick's bleeding finger inside. She sucked up the blood as it continued to ooze, made sure she licked up and down the length of the should-be insured digit to get every last drop. As she did this, her eyes cut straight through the bustle of partygoers to Jimmy. Her eyes met his. Dolly Dagger, she drinks blood from a jagged edge. The back of Jimmy's neck got hot. Fuck was Devin playing at? Trying to be sexy, trying to be provocative, trying to fuck with him? Maybe she had figured out that Jimmy was sweating Marianne Faithful, Mick's current flame, and she was looking to get back at him for any transgression, perceived or real. It wasn't like Jimmy and Devin were exclusive, and they were usually messed up on some piece of smack or coke they had snorted when they were together anyway. Fuck this noise. Jimmy had quit Devin before, he could quit her again. She'd even make it easy for him to make the decision this time. Sucking on Mick Jagger's rock and roll finger at Jimmy's birthday party, Jimmy wasn't having it. Devin could go fuck off, be a honky-tonk woman if she wanted to be a honky-tonk woman. Go give someone else the honky-tonk blues. Jimmy quit Devin for real when Michael Jeffrey sent him to Maui. In Maui, everything was zen. Jimmy stood on the beach and looked out at the horizon, no beginning and no end. When the sun set, the colors melted into one. Life in Maui was a wave, you just caught it and rode on. Life was a yoga pose, breathe in, breathe out, all of the colors all at once. In Maui, Jimmy went cold turkey from Devin. From her temptations, from her manipulations, from her smack he'd been putting up his nose. He arrived in Maui in the summer of 1970 to film a movie called Wave. The director, Chuck Ween, was a veteran of Warhol's factory, and the movie was supposed to be a pro-hippie youth movie response to Easy Rider and the like. The LSD-taking, hippie-sympathizing side of Michael Jeffrey was what got Jimmy involved, not to mention the fact that Jeffrey needed more contracts for more money to ensure that Electric Lady Studios would stay afloat. When it was released a year later, retitled as Rainbow Bridge, it ended up being Jimmy's Magical Mystery Tour. The accompanying album featured some killer tunes, but the film itself was confused, muddled. Nonetheless, Hawaii gave Jimmy some much-needed detox from Devin, from hard drugs, from the road. He ate vegetarian, he read the Tibetan Book of the Dead, and of course, there was plenty of acid and grass going around the movie set. He drank, too. Drank enough that one night. The darkness inside Jimmy looked out. The darkness looked out on the colors that were all bleeding into one, wanted to paint it all black. Tossed off a suggestion to Chuck and the film's lead actress, Pat Hartley, that they should all kill themselves. He quickly retracted it as a joke. But he didn't stop from telling others on the set about his suspicions that he wouldn't live beyond 27. Devin didn't have to be around for the darkness to peek out. In fact, not even 2 months later, it would be back in full force, back in control, and strong enough to drag Jimi Hendrix all the way down to the killing floor with nothing more than a moment's notice. The first thing Jimi Hendrix remembered after blacking out was his face hitting the hardwood. He had been on stage for 8 minutes. 8 minutes, and then it was over. His strat hit the stage floor like a lead balloon. His body followed. Gravity grabbed hold of his body and just yanked, hard, face, meet hardwood, straight down. The greedy handful of sleeping pills he had taken earlier that afternoon didn't want to let go, and they hung off of his eyelids, sat on top of his brain, made it hard to close his jaw. He drooled a little out of the side of his mouth, He struggled to open one of his eyes and saw nothing but dust and dirt vibrating on the stage floor with each stomp that Mitch Mitchell made on his bass drum pedal. He felt like a bull rider, and he rode the beast for 8 minutes before he was ceremoniously thrown off. He had made it, right? Well, shit, wait a minute. Bull riders went on for 8 seconds, not 8 minutes. By that logic, he was a bull rider and then some. 60 seconds per minute. 8 minutes, he was a bull rider 60 times over. Did that logic work out right? A couple of guys that Jimmy didn't recognize, roadies, perhaps stagehands, had picked up his slumped over body and were dragging him by the armpits off the stage. The bullfighter, dressed in red, being ushered to safety away from the bull. In Jimmy's case, he couldn't escape the bull. It was inside him, coursing through his veins. 4,000 strong in our house, Denmark, watching the show, were shocked by Jimmy's sudden departure, and exactly how he had departed. He was there, he hit the deck, he was gone. Some in the audience had seen their fair share of shit shows, but this took the cake. And they were shocked, but they were also pissed, understandably. They'd get a full refund. Jimmy hadn't slept for days. He was stuffed up, stuck in that agonizing limbo state of catching a cold and coming down with something more serious. In addition to whatever he was catching, his head was full of stress and worry. The crack of Michael Jeffries' bullwhip, the love child with Eva Sundquist, the tarot cards in Morocco, the crushing feeling of imminent death, the inability to feel like he had found what he was looking for, that he had yet to become what he was supposed to be, and the non-stop touring. He didn't know where he'd been the day before, never mind where he'd be the next day. Michael Jeffrey had booked this stretch of shows. The Isle of Wight, Stockholm, Denmark, Hawaii, Copenhagen, Germany was next. The bills for Electric Ladyland Studios were continuing to pile up, the debts owed becoming knottier and more worrisome, and they needed cash. Jeffrey needed Jimmy to do his thing, to do it well, to collect that money, and to move on to the next date. Just a few days before, Billy Cox had been dosed with LSD for the first time and had a rough trip. He would ramble like a crazy person and not say a goddamn thing at the same time. And there was a reason why so many people kept far away from LSD, and this was why. Because it wouldn't let some people go. It would become a part of you, forever inside you. And just when you forgot it was there, it would rear its dormant head. For Billy, getting dosed would lead to conspiracy theories, anxiety, and paranoia. And the remnants refused to go away. It was horrifying to watch a guy who was so grounded be all over the place, unglued. Jimmy guided him through it, helped him come down, helped him acclimate. But it took a lot out of him. He was hanging on by a thread. Jimmy didn't know if he could do it, if he could go on. Right now, being dragged off the stage near lifeless by a couple of random do-gooders, he could barely assemble a complete thought in his head, could barely sing a couplet, couldn't really tell you where the fuck he was, obviously couldn't hold a guitar. Gravity had won that battle. Kirsten Neffer was waiting for Jimmy backstage in our house. He had met with the Danish model during his stay at the Isle of Wight Festival only a few days earlier. Like other women he had gravitated towards, Kirsten was someone he wanted to spend all of his spare time with. Talk, hang, meet up backstage, and take their conversation somewhere more private. He gave her his tour schedule and arranged for her to be around. She was in the dressing room at our house before he took the stage, when he had taken all those pills and was talking incoherently. His paranoia was cranked up to 11. He was taking a page from Billy Cox's book. He thought there were spies in his entourage. He was scared that Michael Jeffrey would rather see him dead than continue down a musical path that he didn't deem commercial. He was of two minds, here and there, all at once. He'd clear the mob scene out of the dressing room and then quickly change his mind and ask them all to come back. After the show, Kirsten got Jimmy back to his room at the Hotel Atlantic. Another woman was waiting there for him, but it turned out to be a journalist, not another lover. Anne Borndal was waiting to interview him for an article she was writing for a Norwegian newspaper. He must have let her in earlier, or maybe Jeffrey had. He couldn't be so sure. He threw himself on the couch, clutching his head. It pounded. It felt like the weight of the world. He couldn't stop thinking about Eva and the baby, and Diana and the baby. And now Billy was losing his shit. Clearly he was losing his shit too. The pills and the glasses of clear liquid he had knocked back. He told himself it was just water, to make himself feel better about it. But if it really was water, it was 80 proof water. Water didn't burn like that going down the back of your throat. He had to keep his eyes open. If they closed, he'd be gone forever. Lights out. He had reached the point of no return, and he sat on it, teetering, just one lean away from tipping over into complete and total darkness. A hellmouth to an existential void, right here in a hotel room in Denmark. Jimmy unloaded on the journalist. He talked music and mortality, quoted children's books, went on about planets and stars and drugs. He talked about that death card the clairvoyant had pulled on him in Morocco. "I'm not sure I'll live to be 28 years old," he told her bluntly, just months away from that particular milestone. What was the point of it all? If it was literally in the cards, Jimi Hendrix's foretold death, what was the point of all this running around, all this worrying? Why not just collapse on stage? Why not just close your eyes on a couch? In just a few days' time, however, Jimmy's will to live would kick back in again. That basic human response to clear and present danger, Jimmy would find himself in a helicopter, narrowly avoiding the wrath of armed and angry Hell's Angels on a small German island, and he'd be glad he was alive.
We'll be right back after this word.
From a seat in the helicopter, Jimi Hendrix watched the stage burn from above. The Baltic Sea rose and fell angrily nearby, and the wind howled. Rain, mist, and ocean spray peppered the crowd. With a bird's eye view, the random assortment of parkas, hoods, umbrellas, and tents collected below, the crowd, once 75,000 strong, all appeared to be flanked by one impending disaster or another. Despite the wet and wild weather, the stage caught fire. Jimmy had been on that stage just moments before. The band ended their set with an extended Voodoo Child slight return, and then a stagehand was there, flagging them down, arms flailing. He ushered them down the back of the stairs of the stage and directed them towards a helicopter. The engine was already fired up, the blades picking up momentum. Jimmy, Mitch Mitchell, and Billy Cox were directed to the chopper's open door. Mitch held on to the oversized top hat that he was wearing so that it wouldn't blow away, and the excess of the handkerchief tied around Jimmy's forehead flapped wildly behind him. The urgency in the moment was palpable, even if no one had given the band specific details. The Hell's Angels were rushing the stage. Fights were breaking out in the crowd. Who knew if anyone was going to get paid? They just needed to get the fuck out, ride that chopper back to Hamburg. The Love and Peace Festival, a supposed three-day love fest, it was more like Altamont Redux, a wannabe Woodstock music festival taken hostage by Hell's Angels, biblical weather, anarchic bands, and now, fire. The 60s dream of peace and love may have died at the Rolling Stones' infamous Altamont Speedway show the year before, a disastrous show that resulted in the death of an 18-year-old fan. But on September 6, 1970, its remains were burned on the island off the coast of northern Germany, a funeral pyre for any remaining notions of idealism. Fuck it all nihilism was here to light the match and fan the flames, and its name was Tonstein Scherben. Tonstein Scherben, the German anarchist band playing their first major show, were on the stage and providing a soundtrack from afar as Jimmy and his bandmates pieced out. They launched into a song whose title translated into "Destroy What Destroys You," and the sides of the stage started to smolder, and then the flames peaked out, all red and orange. You could literally see the heat rising off the stage monitors and every last morsel of hope being suffocated. It was all so catastrophically poetic. And the stage was literally on fire. Flanking the stage were German bikers, local Hell's Angels, who had been scaring the shit out of the crowds all day with firearms and threats and general menace. Jimmy lit a cigarette and shook the match out while staring at the bikers, stoned out of their minds on booze and downers, standing next to the flames wearing jean jackets embroidered with swastikas. "You say your mom ain't home, it ain't my concern. Just don't play with me and you won't get burned." Jimmy looked at Mitch and Billy sitting next to him in the helicopter. Their faces were a combination of fear and relief. No one had anything to say, and the phrase "nick of time" was used in moments like these. The Love and Peace Festival was not about love or peace. The signs had all pointed to something more ominous, more dangerous during the three-day event. First, there were the Hell's Angels, hundreds of them. They descended on the island and took over. Unlike Altamont, the Angels hadn't been officially hired, and they took control all the same. They robbed the box office at gunpoint, waved their guns around, kicked, shoved, yelled, fucked up people's cars, upended trailers, took people's booze. And the situation with the bikers got so bad that festival organizers tried to pay them to go away, and that plan didn't work out too well. When Jimmy arrived on site, his tour manager, Jerry Stickles, got whacked on the head with a 2x4. The moment was eerily similar to when Mick Jagger stepped down from the helicopter at Altamont and was whacked upside the head by someone in the crowd. It was a bad omen. Storms came and went. The stage sat next to the Baltic Sea, and giant waves would crash onto the stage and make a bad situation worse. Sandy Denny kept getting shocked by the microphone. The faces, Sly and the Family Stone, Mungo Jerry, Canned Heat, and Ginger Baker's Air Force, all played sets with varying degrees of success. The whole shebang was sponsored by the proprietor of a string of popular German sex shops. Jimmy was on autopilot when he took the stage. He took a puff of something, a two to something else. At this point, he didn't even know what he was ingesting. It was all just routine. Cigarettes stuck to his lips, blue handkerchief tight around his forehead. He flashed a peace sign in the face of destructive, rain-soaked apathy. "How?" crowd jeered at Jimmy and the band. Translation, "Go home." "I don't give a fuck if you boo," Jimmy responded into the mic. "Long as you boo in tune." Despite the catty retort, Jimmy's guitar failed to stay in tune throughout his set, like it didn't want to be there, like it was revolting. The devil ship wasn't sparking that afternoon. His left-hand voodoo just floundered. The rest was noise. As he sat comfortably in the helicopter, the scene below felt made up, pretend, some miniature puppet show of reality bursting fantasy's bubble. Jimmy thought back to Woodstock and how, in the blink of a year, so much had changed. For all its pros and cons, Woodstock, remarkably, had very few, if any, moments of violence or civil unrest. Now you couldn't hold one of these three-day fests without the whole damn thing going to hell. He ascended higher and higher into the air, the din of the copter's blades cycling through his head. He was a man out of time, out of place, a man in search of peace, being airlifted from a site of chaos and unrest. A man who wanted love, albeit on frequently irresponsible terms, fleeing a scene of hate. He didn't belong there. Felt like he was racing against the clock to find his true identity as a performer, to search the experience, gypsy sun and rainbows, band of gypsies, the experience too. Time was slipping away. All of his recent performances were marred by out-of-tune guitars, bad doses, too many pills, too much to drink, not enough rest, anarchists and stage fires and Hell's Angels with guns. He was afraid that he was starting to hallucinate again, seeing things that weren't there, feeling things that weren't there. He knew what he saw. He just couldn't verify if it was real or not. But when he got back to London, something would crawl out of his hotel bathtub, something that freaked him out. It made him question his own sanity. Jimi Hendrix didn't know it then, but the Love and Peace Festival would be the last official show he would ever play. An island off the coast of Germany, overrun by a bunch of angry bikers, would be the final locale to be graced with Hey Joe, with Spanish castle magic. The last time a crowd would hear Purple Haze delivered by its originator. After the near-apocalyptic helicopter ride from the island to Hamburg, Jimmy took a plane to London, checked into the Cumberland Hotel, two rooms. Billy Cox sat in the corner of one, downing pills, rambling on. Paranoia had a healthy grip on him, outweighed perhaps only by exhaustion. Billy slumped in a chair in the corner was a mood. Contagious. Jimmy felt it too. And there was no more skirting around the fact that the whole crew was dead fucking tired. It was a Thursday, September 10th, 1970. He didn't know it then, but the interview he gave to Keith Altham in his room at the Cumberland for the Record Mirror would be the last interview he'd sit down for. Jimmy remained humble as he talked with Altham, denied being the world's greatest guitar player, distanced himself from political songwriting, too unpretentious to take credit for being responsible for anything besides the noises that came from his guitar. Jimi Hendrix also didn't know it then, but the party he attended at the Park Hotel for Mike Nesmith that night would be the last time he'd hang out with his former Monkey tour mates, the last time Jimmy would lay eyes on those big Mike Nesmith mutton chops. Mike could see the stress in Jimmy's face. His face betrayed the fact that his brain was just idling through a rut. In a hallway outside the room at the Park Hotel, Jimmy was still searching, brain dumping on Mike. He told him he wanted to start an R&B band, a big band, horns, the whole shebang, the kind of thing he used to tour behind way back when. Some Chitlin' Circuit shit, some Otis Redding shit. Shout Bamalama, motherfucker. Mike asked Jimmy if he needed company that night. Needed someone to walk him back to his hotel, keep an eye on him. Jimmy waved off the offer. He was cool, everything was cool. He'd be just fine on his own. When Jimmy got back to his room at the Cumberland that night, Otis's Can't Turn You Loose stuck in his head. Man, all that Otis Redding talk, it got him good. And he stepped into the bathroom to take a piss, and while standing there at the head, midstream, heard the shower curtain move. It crinkled and shimmied, causing the rings on the curtain rod to jingle. Jimmy zipped up his pants fast, didn't even bother flushing, and jumped back away from the shower. What the fuck was that? Did he see the curtain move? What was in that drink at Mike Nesmith's party? A hand appeared from inside the shower and pulled the curtain back. It was Otis, in the flesh, double-breasted jacket, tie, shoes shine, dusty as fuck though, just covered in dust, like he'd walked through a construction zone, had stood in the middle of a prairie in a windstorm, or crawled out of the ground. He was sweating, profusely, like he'd just gotten off the stage at Monterey, or you know, crawled out of the ground. Jimmy wiped his arm across his brow, stumbled back some more towards the bathroom door. Otis had been dead for almost 3 years, and now here he was, standing in Jimmy's hotel shower, dusty as fuck, clutching the shower curtain, sweating like a pig. Otis's hand muckled onto the shower curtain tighter. One of his fingers snapped off, popped, just popped right off, and the dust shot into the air like a puffball spore that had been squeezed between two determined fingers. A wet, guttural rumble started up from Otis's chest, like he was trying to clear his throat in slow motion, trying to dislodge something, get something up, testify, tell the truth, spill it, get it out, get it off his chest. He made the sound again. It came on suddenly and then dragged itself out, low and thick and resonant. Jimmy stepped back even farther, his hands grabbing the door frame of the bathroom so that he wouldn't fall on his ass and become a victim to whatever the hell this was. Zombie Otis, Otis of Christmas past. Jimmy didn't hang around to see anything else fall off a dusty dead Otis Redding. He left the half-taken piss in the john. He never stepped foot in that bathroom for the rest of his stay. In fact, he wouldn't spend too much time in the room at the Cumberland at all. The Otis incident shook him. He incidentally received a phone call from across town, from a private hotel in Notting Hill. On the other end of the line was the voice of a pretty blonde German ice skating instructor he had met 18 months earlier. Jimmy had first met Monika Daneman after a show in Dusseldorf at the start of 1969. The show was at Club 66, and Monika attended enthusiastically with her friends. She brought her camera, and she sought Jimmy out at his hotel room that day after the concert, like many other women had done before, and instantly got some FaceTime with her new crush. She had been obsessed with his music ever since she heard him on Radio Caroline, an offshore pirate radio station. She would claim that they spent hours together that day, that she would follow him around to some more shows, watching and waiting from the wings to spend more time with him, that Jimmy would keep in touch with her over the months, that he'd write her and call her, and that he'd long for her from afar. Monika fell hard for Jimmy. In her mind, they were soulmates. Head over heels in love. And they would no doubt get married. She introduced herself as Jimmy's fiance. She claimed that she and Jimmy were meant to be together. She was unlocking the shy and sweet Jimmy from underneath the wild man persona. And she would help him usher in the next phase of his professional life. It all sounded a bit fantastical, hopeful, idealistic, far-fetched, crazy. No one could really be sure what parts of Monica's scenario were true, what was fact and what was fiction. What was true was that Monica and Jimmy would spend 4 days together in London. They would go to parties, shop, take photos, drink tea, talk, spend lots of time at Monica's garden flat. And it would also be true that she would be the last one to see him alive. I'm Jake Brennan, and this is the 27 Club. The 27 Club is scored and co-written by me, Jake Brennan. Zeph Lundy is the lead writer, editor, and co-producer. The 27 Club is mixed and engineered by Sean Cahalan and Matt Bowden, both of whom lent their considerable music talent to the scoring of the series as well. Additional music and score elements by Ryan Spraker. The 27 Club is produced by myself for Double Elvis in partnership with iHeartRadio. Sources for this episode are available at doubleelvis.com on the 27 Club series page. The 27 Club is released weekly every Thursday. Season 1 features 12 episodes on Jimi Hendrix, and Season 2 will feature 12 episodes on Jim Morrison. If you like what you hear, please be sure to subscribe to the 27 Club on Apple Podcasts, the iHeartRadio app, or wherever you get your podcasts. And if you'd like to win a free 27 Club poster designed by the man himself, Nate Gonzalez, then leave a review for 27 Club on Apple Podcasts or hashtag subscribe to 27 Club on social media, and we'll pick two winners each week and announce them on the Double Elvis Instagram page. That's at Double Elvis. You're going to want to give that a follow. So get out there and please spread the word about the 27 Club. As always, you can find me blabbing about other crazy rock stars on my other podcast, Disgraceland, and you can talk to me per usual on Instagram and Twitter, at DisgracelandPod. One way or another, I hope to be talking to you soon. Until then.